I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
This is Jeff Edwards, and you are listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
You know, that, and that's what bars are, right? They're these little escapes. Sometimes they can be many hours long, and sometimes they can just be sort of half an hour and one drink.
That is Kevin Sintemong, culture and lifestyle director of Esquire magazine, discussing their recent America's Best Bars list 2020. Kevin is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. Where did I go? Were you wondering that? Am I flattering myself by thinking some of you might have noticed there was no show last week? Our schedule has been a little erratic, but we did miss an entire week, and I am sorry for that. And if you were wondering where I was, here's the simple truth. I had a bad week. I don't mean anything bad happened, or at least not to me personally. But those of us who live with disorders such as OCD, which happens to be a part of my life, sometimes refer to having a bad day. We and our partners know what that means. Just as physical ailments sometimes flare up, so do mental ones. A bad day just means you woke up one morning feeling a little malfunction-y and overwhelmed. You couldn't get it together. Maybe you spent the day in bed or watching TV or doing frivolous things because you didn't have it in you to focus on work. Or respond to texts, or do the dishes. Basically, you went dark. Now, that sounds pretty lame if you've never had a day like that. And I don't talk about it much because I personally do find it embarrassing, although it's nothing really to be embarrassed about. And I think it is something to be overcome, but I do still have the occasional bad day. And the crazy thing about this pandemic is that people who usually don't have bad days, in the sense that I mean them, meaning quote-unquote normal people, people who aren't afflicted biologically, are having bad days or bad weeks themselves, because that's a perfectly sensible reaction to the coronavirus-fueled mess all around us. How could you not have an occasional bad day right now? Well, if that happens for you, my humble advice is to be aware of it, be with it, accept that it might take you a day or more to pull out of it, and if necessary, be honest with others who might be wondering where you went or just be concerned about you. Don't make it an excuse or lean on it as a crutch, but do respect that we're all still, after all these months, going through something profound and frightening, and it might sometimes take our mental hard drives a minute of spinning to process and catch up. And especially at this time right now, people might surprise you with the capacity to understand and maybe even to identify and be open about this themselves. And it's also, I would say, a lot easier and takes up a lot less energy to be open about this than fighting a losing battle trying to fake that all is well. At least that's my two cents and where I net out on how to handle moments like these when they do crop up, which they do seem to be for pretty much everyone I know right now. Okay, all of that said, I do have a fun show for you today. I had a chance to catch up with Kevin Sintemong, culture and style director for Esquire magazine and Esquire.com the other day. As many of you know, Esquire's food and drinks writer, Jeff Gordonier, is a friend of the pod. And through Jeff, I got to meet Kevin at the Philly Chef Conference this year and got to share an incredible meal and afternoon with him at the wonderful Thai restaurant Kalaya in Philadelphia. And today, he's here to discuss the magazine's annual Best Bars List, or I should say America's Best Bars List. The 2020 edition is out, and it is linked to from the episode page for this show at AndrewTalksToChefs.com. Before I get to that, I do have a quick programming note. If you noticed a change in our opening montage, it's not a fault of your paying attention all these months and years. There actually was a difference. Canadian chef Jeff Edwards is featured at the end. And Jeff recently became a Patreon supporter of the show at what we call the kitchen tour level. That is a super generous $25 per month. As part of that package, he got his name added to the end of the opening montage. So there you go, Jeff. Thank you for your incredibly generous support. If you'd like to learn more about how to support the show yourself, we are now independent and increasingly counting on the support of listeners like you. We do have memberships starting at the $5 per month level. Please visit Patreon. That's patreon.com/AndrewTalksToChefs. And thank you to all of our patrons for your support. It means the world to us, and it will help us keep going in the weeks, months, and years to come. Okay. As I said, our guest today is Kevin Sintemong of Esquire. He put together the recent America's Best Bars 2020 list, along with friend of the pod Jeff Gordonier and a handful of terrific contributors. The list, again, is linked to from the episode page for this conversation at AndrewTalksToChefs.com. And the group of bars featured in this package is a fun and eclectic one of watering holes, fancy and casual, urban and suburban, many of them sporting impressive food programs, and all of them loaded with character and charm. Obviously, this is a poignant time to talk about any subset of the hospitality business, but I think it's also crucial that we keep that beach ball up in the air, maintain our enthusiasm for all of these businesses, and of course, support those that are open for outdoor or takeaway drinking and dining right now. So I did think it was an appropriate conversation to have, even in this somewhat strange context. I don't think I need to say any more about it. We explain a lot about the feature and the contributors and many of the bars in the interview. So let's get to my conversation with Kevin Sintemong. Here you go.
Usually, you know, this is about my third year doing it. And every March, early April, it's kind of a flurry of reporting between me and Jeff Gordonier. We kind of do report the bulk of the list. And so we do a lot of drinking in March and April. But this, it was weird because this is when, right when the pandemic started, is when we were supposed to be going out the most, and we couldn't. And so, you know, I snuck in one last drink on a reporting trip out in LA. That was a bar that was on the list. It's this beautiful bar called The Prince in Koreatown. What I loved about it and what spoke to me about The Prince was that it was kind of this, it's a bar that's been around for a really long time. And yet a lot of people who I knew who lived in LA didn't know about it. I took a friend there, my friend Amanda, who's lived in LA for a really long time, and she hadn't been there. So it was great. It was a great feeling to sort of have this last kind of drink with her, to have this great experience. But I had no idea that was going to be like one of my last drinks. When I got back to New York, the bar started closing down. I kind of felt like I was in the Dead Don't Die, that Jim Jarmusch movie, where basically the zombies come back, but they come back doing the things that they love, even though they're kind of dead, or the world is in chaos. They go, you know, they play tennis. They go get coffee at the diner, and that's kind of the way I felt. I couldn't not go to bars. I even if they were closed, that's the path that I took. Was just I would just go to bars just to look at them, see if, you know, say hi to anyone that was sort of closing down. I live in Cobble Hill in Brooklyn, and which is one of the best kind of drinking neighborhoods in America. And, you know, I'm biased, of course, but we have Long Island Bar, we have Leyenda, we have Clover Club, we have Grand Army, we have Montero's, which is a great sort of old classic, kind of almost like longshoreman type of bar. And I just couldn't, because it was so ingrained in me to visit bars during this time, I just couldn't help it. You know, it's to me like bars, like restaurants are to you and to many other people. I feel like a part of, you know, my community, really. And that's kind of the mind space I was in. I just needed to sort of be there, not even to get a drink. It was just sort of, that was kind of, you know, part of me. There was comfort in sort of going to these places, even though they were closed. And then eventually they did start doing takeout pretty pretty early in New York, and a lot of people, a lot of bar owners had campaigned for that. I think with some people, it really did make a difference. You know, I think it made just getting a little bit of income as opposed to zero income. But it's still very hard for bar owners in New York and across the country right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's triage, right? I mean, it's financial triage, basically. I just have to quickly, before you say anything else, on two quick personal notes. One is, I used to live on Butler Street in Cobble Hill, the same block as Leyenda. That's also the street that Public Records is on. I have not been to Public Records. I do get back to the old neighborhood, as they say, a lot. I live in the burbs now, but I have a lot of friends in that area. It made me nostalgic, you know, because if you guys refer to it, I think, as an industrial stretch. And it really is. I mean, that's like around the corner from the Gowanus housing, development. And it's exactly what people think of when they think of kind of the beginnings of what's become modern Brooklyn, you know, these kind of outposts in very unlikely places, which is still exciting to me. The other thing I have to mention is, you know, you mentioned the Prince in Los Angeles, and this is a funny coincidence, but my last restaurant meal until they started doing outdoor dining again recently in New York City was at Huni Kim's restaurant, Donji. In New York City. That was a lunch I had on Wednesday, March 11th. I remember it vividly. And but the place that I frequent of Huni's is Hanjan. You'll appreciate this as a journalist. I was for about 10 years an editor-at-large at Tennis Magazine, and their offices are about three blocks from Hanjan. And once in a while, my editor and I would meet on a Friday afternoon, have lunch at the bar, and we were in love with ice cold height beer.
Oh yes.
And in your write up, I got another nostalgic twinge, because in your write up, which you did of the Prince, yes, you mentioned get an ice cold height. And to me, there's nothing better on a day like today, at least in New York, than a height beer, like an ice cold height beer. I mean, it made me want to go find some.
It's great. Yeah, it totally hits the spot and is great with the Korean fried chicken. I mean, that's one of the killer combinations at the Prince. I believe that's even on there as like a combo thing that you can order. is like a big
like a
large format height and the Korean fried chicken.
Oh my God, that would be so good.
And that's the thing. It's just sort of like, you know, bars, they're more than kind of places you drink, right? Unlike restaurants, restaurants are a commitment, right? I mean, it depends what kind of restaurant it is, but, and you know, you have to eat, everyone's got to eat, but with bars, it's a really sort of, kind of conscious choice to, either be alone. You know, I've become a pro at drinking by myself, since I've been doing kind of bar reporting for the past 10 years. And that's, it's, you know, I've come to sort of enjoy that, I used to never be sort of like the type of person that would just go to the bar, just talk to the bartender, or read a book, or now, you know, look at Instagram. Although I try to do that a lot less. I actually do try to sort of talk to people, and talk to bartenders especially. Unlike restaurants are, it's a different thing. It just sort of hits a different kind of social note, than a restaurant does. And it really does feel, to me at least, more like a community, because I feel like you could just kind of pop in for a drink for like half an hour, where you can't really do that with a restaurant. So that's why I really love bars is sort of the social community aspect of it. And you can kind of visit a lot of people in one evening.
Do you see a, you know, I was struck reading this, how many of these places, you know, you mentioned the fried chicken at the Prince, you know, how many of these places serve food and not just food? I mean, you know, these reference points, I'll date myself probably a few times in this conversation, but, you know, most people traditionally don't, you know, there, you know, there's a phrase, bar food, right? It's usually hot wings and a burger. And there's, you know, a lot of these places have very specific cultural reference points. A lot of them are outgrowths of or extensions of the personal history and backgrounds of the barkeep or the owner. And reading through this list, I was really struck at that I don't really discern in a lot of cases much of a difference, except maybe in the proportions of what you drink versus what you eat, between these places and what most people would think of as a restaurant. And I'm just curious to get your comment on that.
Oh, right. So it's where do you draw the line between a bar and a restaurant and a restaurant, a bar?
Or if you even need to.
That's a tough one. It's sort of like, you know, it when you're there, you know, and it's sort of the and it's kind of like, it does the place want to be considered a bar, then I'll consider it a bar. Does the place want to be considered a restaurant, then we'll consider it a restaurant, you know? And a lot of people are, you kind of have to just sort of go, well, one place, a lot of places, like I said, they put themselves out there as a bar, so they're a bar, but then other places you kind of have to sort of just feel it out. As far as like with consideration for, you know, what goes on the list and what we consider a bar, there's no sort of hard and fast rule, right? I think that if you look at a lot of places on this list, there's like Public Records is kind of, it's like a music venue, record shop, restaurant, coffee shop, you know. You know, Graft in Charleston, that's kind of like a wine shop too. You know, Bamboo Room, that to me definitely feels more like a bar. There's a physical bar and the bar itself takes up most of the space. But then again, I go to a lot of restaurants where it's just the bar, you know? So it's a tough call, but I feel like other, like you said, if there's more of a focus on the drinks as opposed to the food percentage wise, it's probably more of a bar.
I just thought of an answer. This might be just a New York thing, but in pre-pandemic New York, I would say, if you're able to come in and have a table and just drink, it's a bar.
That's a good one.
And if they don't make, yeah, you know, if you don't have to order food in order to have some real estate, it's a bar.
Yes. I think that's a good rule.
But that might just be New York. Okay. I want to talk about a couple of these that really jumped out at me, but I have to ask you first off too, just very broadly speaking, you know, you know, you think of Esquire, you think of the heritage of the magazine, the history of the magazine. You know, you think of it as kind of a men's magazine. You think of it as this magazine that traditionally has kind of written these articles of, you know, 25 things every man should be able to do, and, you know, how to tie a bow tie, and, you know, here's your essential wardrobe. And I got about halfway through this list, and it really struck me how many of the bartenders, owners, mixologists, whichever applies in each case, were women. This is a very female, maybe even almost dominant list. I was really struck. Did that strike you? Does that feel like a sea change that's happening? And you know, in New York, we have these figures like Julie, you know, from Clover Club, and Ivy Mix at Leyenda. I mean, it's nothing really that unusual, but to see this national concentration on this list, really, that was one of my big takeaways, actually. Not that you guys call it out or make a big deal about it, but for me, once I got about halfway through, I thought, wow, this is not an army of Dale DeGroffs, you know?
Dale's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. But yeah, there's, I think, you know, women have always owned bars. Women have always been behind the bar. I think that, I mean, Jeff and I, we really try to be as inclusive as possible, visit as many places as possible, talk to people not, within our circle, but a little bit outside of our circle. And so, I mean, thank you for noticing that. We definitely work hard at trying to be inclusive and diverse, however you want to say that. But we can definitely work harder, and we will work harder each year to broaden our views on what makes a great bar. When I started sort of doing bar reporting, right? And I kind of came of age. I was fortunate to come of age in New York of like drinking age, right when, Milk and Honey kind of opened, right? And so I just became a cocktail nerd pretty early on when I was like able to legally drink. So I was really into just these kind of, for lack of a better term, fancy cocktail places. And so I would, when I kind of judged a bar, I would like, I was kind of an ice nerd. I would always, figure out whether what they were doing to their ice. Did they have the super crystal clear ice? Were they using pebble ice? I would ask the bartender questions about the ice machines, whether they had like modified their cold draft machine so you get that kind of perfect cube. Which, by the way, I think if you do that, you avoid the warranty. But I for a while I was just sort of very kind of focused on that. But then over the years, I loosened up a bit. I'm less sort of precious about my cocktails and really kind of tuned into the vibe of the place and whether it's how you, like I say in the introduction to the spot, it's sort of like how it makes you feel, whether you want to send your other friends there, whether you want to go back, and a lot of times I want to go back. Sometimes I want to go back just to a bar, just for a drink. But sometimes I want to go back to a bar because I like the people there. I like the vibe, and sort of the drinks almost become this secondary thing.
Yeah, that is. I mean, when we were talking earlier about what differentiates a bar, I do think, I guess the term came about in connection to Quentin Tarantino movies, the idea of a hangout movie. I feel like bars are hangout places. I think one of the write-ups in here actually uses the word hang. But again, that notion of, meals have very set times. You generally don't have a reservation at a bar, although it's not an impossibility, today. But yes, that notion of that you can just kind of soak up the ambiance of a place on your own schedule, as it's as it's unfolded on that on a given day is, I think, one of the real romantic things about them. I also wanted to ask you about the contributors. I mean, with yourself included, I believe there are seven, one of whom is Jeff Gordonier. But Beth Ann Fennelly, Omar Mamoun, Osayi, I hope I'm pronouncing her last name right, Ndolin, Stephen Satterfield, and Adrian.
Adrian Westenfeld, yeah.
What's the process? Not all these people are on staff, obviously. Do you put feelers out to a group and say, hey, do you have any good candidates for this? Do you assign a certain number of people based on geography to contribute? What's the process?
There's not like sort of a set process, really. I think that some years it's more Jeff, some years it's more me. I think a lot of it is like where have we been able to sort of go out there that year? What, it's just we don't have a lot of people on staff. But we generally I try to ask everyone on staff what bars they're kind of most excited about. I like to bring in outside contributors, and I want to bring in more contributors. And all those people, I trust their taste. I like their writing. I've had drinks with most of them. And and I've gotten to know them. So this goes back to sort of the idea of the list. You know, we really do spend a lot of time reporting this list. It's not, I think other publications, other brands, whatever you want to call them, handle their lists in a different way, and that's fine. But with the Esquire Best Bars list, I feel like it's always had a very kind of very, it's been focused. There's a viewpoint to it, and it's hard to really to sort of describe what that is. And I think it taps into sort of what's happening in the bar industry during a particular year, and we try to sort of be on the pulse of that. This year, we had a lot of wine bars, and you're seeing a lot of more wine bars. I'm spending a lot of more time in wine bars. And so I wanted to reach out to people. I wanted to include people that had been to more, you know, frankly, had been to more wine bars than I had, you know, and knew more people in that world and knew that scene more. And so that's why I wanted to incorporate those people in. A lot of it simply comes down to geography as well. You know, I hear about a great spot in the South where I unfortunately don't get to go down there as much. And so I'll, you know, we have quite a few sort of trusted people down there that we start a conversation with and talk about what kind of awesome drinking experiences they've had over the past year, 2 years. So yeah, to answer your question, it's part of its geography. A lot of it is sort of these are sort of trusted people that whose tastes and viewpoints I really appreciate. And we try to sort of broaden our perspective each year. You know, I think that, like I said, I think early on, everyone was really into sort of nerding out on cocktails, and I'm really trying to sort of broaden out of that. Like this, we have wine shops this year. We have a bookstore. You know, we have a place like Public Records, and that's also another sort of like mini trend is sort of the listening bar, right? Bar where you just have a drink and spend hours listening to records, which is quite a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that I love that. I need to ask you about as a native Floridian. Well, not native, but I moved there when I was two. There is a bar listed here in Disney World.
Yeah.
Called Oga's Cantina, and it sounds like the inspiration was the cantina scene in, well, I'll always think of it as the first Star Wars, but what's now officially Episode 4, A New Hope. It's where we first meet Han Solo, but everybody knows that scene. But this kind of blew my mind to see this on this list. And you do say here, you know, for many, the first memory of a bar is likely Episode 4's cantina scene. Who didn't want to? Oh, here it is. Who didn't want to hang out there? There's that verb I was looking for. That would explain the constant lines outside Oga's Cantina.
Yeah.
That to me was the big. I mean, I don't even. If it does seem, as you said, you know, it seems of a piece with the list. But that would, to me, was a real find. How did that come on your guys' radar? And was that a tough call?
A little. We discussed it a lot. You know, and I had always, I wasn't able to sort of get down there, but I wanted to kind of do a bigger story about on Oga's Cantina. Adrian, fortunately, was down there, of course, pre-pandemic, and really loved it. And I've talked to a lot of people who have loved it as well. And so, I mean, that's, there were enough people where that I had, whose taste I trusted, who said that's, it's kind of a, you know, it's definitely a fun experience. To be honest, I think some people were sort of mixed on the drinks themselves. But I think it's hard to beat that, you know, walking into this, fantasy. Right. And like for me, I think for a lot of people, you know, of a certain age, that was your first time sort of experiencing, at least on screen, what a bar was like, what, you know, as a kid. I remember seeing that and I'm like, that's kind of cool. That's where, I want to be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. I mean, I, as we're talking about it, I can hear that music, you know, the dun, 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 you know, like I can, I can still hear that from when I was like seven, whatever I was when I first saw it. I can still hear the music. I can, I remember, and you know, you, and it's funny because you see it now and, you know, none of those costumes are particularly convincing, you know, the various aliens, but, you know, it was hilarious. You know, it was supposed to be a little dangerous, right? There were all these kind of, you know, reprobates hanging out there, this intergalactic, you know, group of reprobates. And, you know, that was like a dangerous bar, right? But it was, but it's indelible. It is indelible.
It was about the vibe, right? And this fulfilled so many kind of fantasies for so many people, and that's why there's like a line there. You know, how can a bar where there's like a line around the block not be on the best bars list? I mean, I think for a lot of people, like, this is it was probably one of the most important bar openings of last year, you know. So a lot of people, a lot of people might not even go to a bar, but they'll go to this bar, you know, and I want to go to this bar, and I'm like a cocktail nerd. So, and I feel like that hits so many marks, right? And there's lots of bars where it's just, I really love the kind of fantasy aspect of bars too. I think, of course, people will tell you that, like, haters will say that the sort of like the speakeasy thing is over, but I still like a good kind of speakeasy. I still like a good, you know, secret entrance every once in a while. I think there was a while where there was just like too much of them, and that I felt like everyone had to build that into their bar. But now I feel like that's, you know, the great ones have sort of settled into that. And I still like going to PDT. I still get a kick out of the phone booth. You know, Raised by Wolves in San Diego, you go to a mall, and then you go to a liquor store in the mall, and then you sit by this fireplace, and the false wall like flips around, and then you're in this crazy like Belle Epoque, like hunting lodge, like fever dream, right? And it's hard to beat that, you know, and you know, that, and that's what bars are, right? They're these little escapes. Sometimes they can be many hours long, and sometimes they can just be sort of half an hour and one drink. To get back to the cantina, I mean, that's like, you know, that's an escape within an escape. You're going down to, you know, the Star Wars theme park, you know, in Disney World or Disneyland. It was a lot of talk around it, but once we, you know, had really sort of discussed what makes a great bar, we're like, that should be on the list. And I'm appreciative of all the people who that kind of surprised as well. I feel like it's always good to have a good a list where you're like, oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, I was fascinated by it. I also think it, you know, it's about as unsnobby a pick as you can have, which I think is a good thing. You know, reading through this, and it's funny because this came up on another interview we just did the other day. Actually, we did a special where we were talking about the food of Pulp Fiction.
The Kahuna Burger.
The Big Kahuna Burger. So when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out a million years ago, and Spielberg and Lucas were giving all these interviews about that movie, which was basically them taking old, you know, Saturday morning cliffhangers and turning it into a very technically accomplished, you know, blockbuster motion picture, big budget and all that. You know, the line that they had was that they made the movies that they wanted to see, right? And, you know, I think that's true of Quentin Tarantino. I think he's very in touch with that part of himself. And that's, you know, I think what leads to these kind of crazy on paper movie ideas that he has. I mean, all of his movies are kind of mashups, I think, to some degree. But I feel like reading through this list, I do feel like a lot of these bars are very kind of personal, idiosyncratic, you know, on paper, illogical kind of combinations. you know, that you're kind of getting this look into kind of, you know, almost like an authorial, you know, like a writerly look into the sensibility and life of whoever it is that kind of came up with this place. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like,
it's,
you know, it can be very quirky. There's this real, a lot of them have a very I don't mean this in a bad way. I mean this in the best way, kind of a bizarre combination of factors that would make you want to go just, be in this place. You know, like you said, treat it like an escape. You know, one of these places closes on, what is it, the nights of the full moon, when there's full moon? Is that what it was?
The place in Atlanta.
Or the eclipse? Full moon. Yeah, Cardinal. Cardinal in Atlanta. They close... Yeah, which is a speakeasy and a food court vibe. It's written here by Stephen Satterfield. And it is closed for full moons. Now, that sounds nuts, right? But that's also, that's great. That's great. And why not? You know, you talked about these listening bars would be another example. One of them is a wine and American ham bar. That's Ann Sons in Brooklyn. You know, and it goes on and on. In Chicago, Kumiko, I think is how we say it, Julia Momose's background, her Japanese heritage, you say here. Here, to drink at Kumiko is to witness a personal journey into bartender Julia Momose's Japanese heritage. I mean, that says what I was trying to say much more succinctly. But that's kind of you think of the traditional bar and... almost none of what I'm saying would have, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, bar, you know, if it had a good jukebox and, you know, the lighting was right, you were a good beer list, you're pretty happy. This full immersive experience to me is something that's so exciting.
I think the best restaurants, the ones I really love, tell a story, right? The menu tells a story, the food tells, each dish tells a story. The decor tells a story, right? And I think it's the same thing with bars as well. You know, I think it's sort of, I like to see a place where the kind of personality comes through, where the weirdness comes through, frankly. And that's what I try to kind of seek out on my travels. And I think that's what a lot of other people seek out on their travels as well, right? Are these, these experiences that just kind of, you know, these kind of memories that you want to create for yourself that aren't like any other sort of place that you've kind of go to regularly, or just to kind of get back to who I'm kind of thinking of when we're kind of putting together this list, who we're thinking of when we're putting together this list. I always like to think of a person who's kind of on vacation or on a business trip, and they, you know, have time for maybe like one or two places to go to. I kind of want to send them to a weird, interesting place where they're going to kind of get to know the people there, get to know the owners, and get to kind of know the community, right? And kind of might sort of open their minds in a way that they might not have otherwise, right? Especially when you're kind of on a business trip, a lot of times you just don't have the time. You're just going to like the hotel bar. Lots of great hotel bars. I always like to send people to just kind of a weird place that will kind of change their viewpoint of a city, really. And I think that a lot of these places can kind of do that. Introduce you to a new aspect of Atlanta, of Chicago, of Cleveland.
Right. And also in a strange way for an hour of your time there, take you to a totally different place, right? To take you on a little bit of a trip, a lot of these places. And we should say not all of these places are I guess what we would say are cutting edge or necessarily forward looking. You know, you do have Martuni's in San Francisco, which is an institution, as you all say in the article. I don't know. I mean, I have to tell you, I just love the list. I mean, I just love the list, as I do all the Esquire lists these days, I have to say. I mean, I'm a little partial because Jeff does a lot of those and I'm, you know, we're pals. Can I just ask you your personal take? I have to tell you, you mentioned Wadkabar, and I'm not being cute. It is spelled with a W in Cincinnati. I guess they're being cute because it's vodka, but they're putting a little, I guess, a little Russian mustard on it. You know, I kind of even missed the moment when vodka became unfashionable. Until I was told that it happened, and you know, there were some bars that didn't have vodka, and you know, that was kind of mind blowing to me. The first time I went to a bar that didn't have, not that I don't really order vodka. I'm not a vodka guy. Once in a while, a vodka martini, if you believe in such things.
Dirty vodka martini.
Yeah, I'm just saying if you believe in such things, because obviously some, you know, as you know, some purists think that. So there's no such thing. It's only with gin. But where do you stand on vodka? Was that just a moment when it went out of fashion? Do you have anything against it? What's your personal opinion? What's your personal opinion about this poor spirit?
I mean, vodka is still, as far as I know, the best selling spirit in America, possibly the world. I mean, whiskey's getting there, of course. When it comes to bars, vodka is king. And a lot of people, that's what they drink. They just want vodka. I think, you know, when did vodka become sort of like unfashionable with sort of cocktail snobs? I think that was really when this kind of second cocktail renaissance, golden age, whatever you want to call it, started bubbling up, right? In sort of 2001, 2002, 2003, early aughts, if you'd say. And you know, the kind of misconception, I would say, is that vodka has no flavor. It doesn't add anything to a cocktail. You know, it's for people who are kind of like, just don't like the taste of gin. And I never really subscribed to that. I kind of always loved vodka. I know Jeff does. Jeff wrote up a vodka bar in Cincinnati. And like, I remember, Pravda. Do you remember Pravda on Lafayette Street? It was once owned by Keith McNally.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
I mean, talk about fantasy. That place was incredible. You know, you walk down the stairs and you were like in this, felt like an underground subway station in like Moscow or something. And it was lovely. And I loved all the sort of infused vodkas. If somebody says like a drink is out of style, I don't believe in that. You should drink what you want to drink. You know, if you like your martini, like a vodka martini shaken with like three olives and just a touch of brine in it, go for it. You know, I get the idea of trying to be a snob about being like anti-vodka, but me personally, I'm not that way. During this pandemic, I think everyone has been sort of going through their kind of like archives and you know, finding their dusties and stuff. And I had a lot of vodka on hand. I think mainly because I'm definitely more of like a whiskey drinker at home, definitely more of like kind of Manhattan drinker than I am sort of a vodka drinker or martini drinker. But during the pandemic, vodka just felt right. It's like vodka on the rocks at like, you know, 4:59 or whatever, you know, wherever we're close to 5 o'clock. I'm like, yep, I'm just gonna have give myself. It was, it felt. I just needed a little bit something clean and cold to sort of like take the edge off from, you know, reading the news, reading the news and all the awful stuff. It felt very appropriate. And so, yeah, I'm all for vodka. I'm all for people loving vodka. And I yeah I and if you don't like vodka, that's fine too. But I think that a lot of people do, and not I don't think that vodka drinkers need to be told this, but you shouldn't be ashamed of if you like vodka. Go for it. It's there's a lot of awesome vodkas in there. And if you're like kind of more of a cocktail nerd, there's are a lot more kind of handcrafted small, you know, vodkas from smaller places, like St. George, out in California. They make a vodka called all-purpose vodka. That's all purpose. That's wonderful. They make one that's infused with peppers. That's absolutely delicious. Just I drink that just straight on the rocks. Vodkas for me, it's all about the kind of creaminess, the mouthfeel, the body. Carlson's is another great one. Potato vodka. Yeah, we this is quickly turning into the vodka podcast.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I have to say though, you're a man after my heart. When you said 4:59, I'm gonna have a drink. Because well, first of all, my wife usually works in the city. We live in the suburbs, so it's never been a logistical possibility. But you know, I had to stop after a few months. It was, to be honest, getting a little, not that I was getting hammered every night, but I mean, I think there was a good 3 month stretch where I had at least two drinks a day. And at like
Sure.
4:59, she's working at home, obviously, right now. You know, we had a cocktail hour. I mean, we had cocktail hour in
Sure.
our house. And our bar has never been as well stocked. I mean, I'm sure yours is always well stocked, but you know, we had kind of our favorite things. And now, you know, for several weeks, I was putting in a weekly curbside order to my favorite local liquor store. And we just kept expanding based on what we were in the mood for that week. And, you know, to the point where we were making, you know, taking about once a week, I would stick my head out the side door and ask our next door neighbors if I could make them a drink. And I could pretty much do, you know, like a piano man who could do anything on request. I could pretty much make whatever they wanted. Because
That's
we had
awesome.
stocked up, which is fun, which is fun. So before we wrap up, Kevin, what is there one or two, do you have one or two just places that either hit you personally just right, or that, you know, you're especially looking forward to being able to be on the road again and trying maybe one of the ones that a contributor put on the list? Is there one that's just kind of a you know, just a bullseye for you, you know, your own, for whatever reason, just, you know, that you're personally very curious about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm good. Like I told you sort of earlier, I'm kind of driving across the country now. So, going back to Chicago, and Kumiko is doing, and Julia, she's doing to-go cocktails there. So, I'm definitely going to swing by there and get some cocktails for a journey.
Oh,
And
that's great.
that's the other fun thing with like to-go cocktails, especially on sort of a trip like I'm on now, is that I'm you know I'm if they'll last, I'll hold on to some and sort of share them with people in another state, you know, and I feel like that's kind of a fun thing. But yeah, Kumiko is wonderful. Definitely looking forward to get back there. I keep going back to the Prince because I just kind of love how kind of strange it is, in such a good, like, charming way. You know, it feels like this old kind of madman place, but like you know, it used to be this old sort of steakhouse, in a hotel, but it's taken on a life of its own, even though like the decor hasn't changed. And to me, that's just something really special, especially in a place like in LA where there's lots of, you know, weird hidden places. It was nice to kind of be introduced to that from another friend. And speaking of the Prince, I have told other people that I was going to put the Prince on the list, and I encounter this a lot where it's like, they're like, don't put that on the list. You'll ruin it.
Right, right.
And I never listen to them because I don't think a place can necessarily kind of get ruined by our list. I hope not. I hope that never happens. I know that sometimes can happen in the restaurant world, but I feel like this day and age, you know, bars, especially now, they need kind of more support than ever. And that's why we waited on, you know, this list was out in the magazine for a while, but we kind of waited for what felt like a better time to sort of put out the list online where more people would be able to see it. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the bars on the list are closed, but a lot of them are open. And I'm hoping that this kind of, you know, generates more more traffic. More safe traffic for them, I should say. And then, you know, going back to the other bars that I love, I mean, definitely want to go down to Oga's Cantina. That's just, that would fulfill, like I said, a kind of a long held childhood fantasy for me. And Public Records as well, you know, which is in you know, really close to where I live. I love just kind of going there and just kind of zoning out on the music there. Just awesome music selection.
Yeah, it's funny what you say about people not wanting to or saying please don't write about it, because I'm not even sure. I read somewhere that they weren't going to reopen, and then I guess now I hear from somebody told me they heard they might reopen. So I'm not sure what the fate is. But 701 West, which is in the Edition, which is in the Edition Hotel. It's the bar. It was you know, John Fraser's restaurant there, and the bar there. And I think Jeff Gordonier wrote that up, and I texted him when the list came out, and I said, that was my secret, because it was mainly known as a restaurant. But have you been to that one yourself?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, Jeff and I went back and forth on who was going to write that. But I graciously let Jeff write it up. Jeff's a much better writer than I am, anyway. But I really love that bar. Yeah.
Oh God, it's a beautiful little. It's like a beautiful little jewel box of a room. You know, they served you like a little, whatever the cocktail equivalent of an amuse is, you know, with your, like, whatever they were giving you with the little olives or nuts or whatever, and these beautiful little dishes. You know, they would give you like a little cordial glass, maybe with just a taste of whatever punch or something they had made that day. And it was, and never all that crowded, right? So that was such a find.
Right.
So to your point, I did write, you know, I did write Jeff, and I said, you know, that was, and he and I had never talked about it, but I said, you know, that was my little secret. That was my little secret place. If I needed, well, this brings it full circle, because if I needed a place where I could meet someone for a drink and have a table, you know, like to have a conversation, maybe for, you know, some kind of a work appointment, it was perfect. It was just perfect. Well, Kevin, thank you for all this. Thanks for taking time out during your road trip. I'm glad our internet connection lasted through all this, and congrats to everybody on the list, and congrats to you guys, you know, for getting it out in a way that I think struck such a sincere and I thought correct tone for kind of where we are right now and where they are, meaning the bars, the bar owners are right now, which is obviously a very precarious place. So I would encourage people, if any of these bars in your area are doing takeout or, if they're open outdoors, if any of them are able to be doing that, you know, please do check them out. I'm sure they would love to see you. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. This is a lot of fun. And go out there and safely support those bars when you can.
Thank you again to Kevin Sintemong. Please check out America's Best Bars 2020 at Esquire.com. Again, that is linked to from the episode page for this show on AndrewTalksToChefs.com and from the Apple Podcast description for this episode. The links there are functional as well. Before we say goodbye this week, we need to pay our respects to Robert Lee Jones, the patriarch of the Jones family of the Chef's Garden in Ohio, who passed away on August 4th. Many of you out there probably know the Chef's Garden, and we just had Robert's son, Farmer Lee Jones, I should say one of his sons, on the show just in March. Here he is talking about his dad.
And at one point, there were 330 vegetable growers here. And my dad was in what they called truck farming. He grew about, at the end, 1,200 acres of fresh market vegetable. You started planting in the spring from the first moment you could get in the ground, and you continued to plant to the last day in the fall that you could possibly make a crop.
Robert Lee Jones was 79 years old. I have been privileged to know the Jones family for years. I consider them and their colleagues there at the Chef's Garden and their chef, Jamie Simpson, good friends. I've been their guest at the Chef's Garden and the Culinary Vegetable Institute many times, and I'm very fond of all of them. Please join me in sending them a virtual hug at this sad time. And if you would like to support the farm at this very trying time and treat yourself to some world-class produce, please visit them at chefs-garden.com and check out the For Home produce boxes they began selling and shipping in March. It is some of the best stuff you will ever eat. That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to seeing you back here soon with another edition of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Even with scars.